DW Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Africa Link with me, Assumpta Latus, and my wonderful colleague here,
Mimi Mefo. We are live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. You can always comment on any of the topics we are covering here and we would read it out whenever we can.
Coming up on the program, Liberian lawmakers endorse the establishment of the War and Economic Crimes Court. We hear from a victim.
In my presence, I saw other ladies. They were killed right before me and I saw them. And those who did this thing, they are still passing around in this country. So I'm very happy that the president has written the legislature finally.
And indifference in Rwanda after the killing of Hutu militia commander.
Has been some sort of blackout, really. That no one seems to be talking about him. I don't know if it's intentional. He has been more popular in Congo.
Stay tuned for those stories and more, but first, other world stories in brief.
DW News.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Algerian authorities have arrested a leading pro-democracy activist on Thursday. That's according to a human rights lawyer who says Fodil Boimala was detained and placed in custody on charges of harming national unity. A court in the capital, Algiers, said an investigative judge ordered Boimala to be placed in custody pending further questioning. He is the third opposition activist to be detained this week on similar charges. The ongoing protests demanding an overhaul of Algeria's political system led to the resignation in April of autocratic President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. And Tunisia's ousted President Zine Abidine Ben Ali has died in exile in Saudi Arabia, according to his lawyer. Ben Ali fled Tunisia in 2011 after Tunisians rose up against his two-decade-long oppressive rule. His death comes just days after a presidential election in Tunisia. A U.S.-based watchdog released a damning report Thursday, finding that the largest oil group in South Sudan provided direct support to deadly militias. The Sentry, which monitors corruption in Africa, said it had uncovered links between the Dar Petroleum Company and mass atrocities during the country's five-year civil war that claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. A co-founder of the watchdog, Hollywood actor George Clooney, said he has called on the U.S. to expand sanctions on those involved. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his main political rival Benny Gantz will begin consultations on Sunday to decide on the next prime minister. It comes after Tuesday's general election failed to provide either of them a clear majority. The politically weakened Netanyahu hinted on Thursday of a possible power-sharing deal with Gantz after repeatedly failing to win a ruling majority during two elections this year. Liberian President George Weah has declared a day of mourning after at least 26 school children and one teacher died in a fire at a religious school. Authorities have opened an investigation into the cause of the incident. The imam at the Islamic school has warned that the death toll could rise. In Nigeria, the army has sealed off an office of the nonprofit Action Against Hunger group in the northeastern city of Maiduguri after six employees were reportedly taken hostage by jihadists. A member of the staff said they were evacuated on Wednesday and that the army has been standing guard ever since. And finally, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's coalition government said it plans to invest at least 100 billion euros on climate protection by 2030. That's according to a draft policy discussed on Thursday. Merkel's conservatives and the center-left Social Democrats are expected to announce the landmark policy package on Friday. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You're listening to Africa Link, broadcasting live from Bonn, Germany. I'm Assumpta Latus.
And I am Mimi Mefo. On our Facebook page, the debate has already started, Assumpta. Mm-hmm. I can already see Iya Bekoe, who says that I am here, DW Africa, watching live from Yaoundé. Iya, I can see you. Monju, I can see you as well. Keep the debate going. We are going to be reading your comments in the course of this program.
Indeed. We begin the show in Liberia. The writing on the walls for the possible establishment of the War and Economic Crimes Court is getting clearer by the day as lawmakers today give their backing on its implementation. President George Weah, for the first time, wrote to the national legislator seeking their advice for the establishment of the court.
Now, from every indication, Liberia is gravitating towards acceptance to prosecute those implicated in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report, which committed gross human rights violations and abuse of state resources during the country's 14 years of civil war. Evelyn Pade tells us more from Liberia.
Victims of Liberia's civil war, like Azayane, are very hopeful that ongoing discussions emanating from the president's recent letter will mean justice for him and other Liberians.
During the war, I was here. 1990 war, I didn't go anywhere. I lost my cousin. And also, in my presence, I saw other ladies. They were killed right before me, and I saw them. And those who did this thing, they are still passing around in this country. So I'm very happy that the president has written the legislature finally for the war crime code. So I need justice in this country.
Liberia's human rights and justice campaigner, Adaman Dempster, says it is a timely move.
The possibility is yes, and indeed we are just on the finish line. So this, I don't see any difficulties ahead of us until otherwise. It is a collective approach for everyone to be a part of this whole establishment of the war crimes court, so that one may not take a blame for taking a decision to establish a court, or they may not undermine the security of the state, or we may not have a difficulties in selling the proposal for the war crimes court.
The ball is now in the court of the legislature. In order for the war crimes court to be established, the legislature must have 2/3 votes from both houses, the members of the House of Representatives. Henson Kezulu explains about progress made so far.
The culture of impunity is about to come to an end. And I can tell you we have up to about 47 signatory on that resolution. We're waiting for 2 other pressing, then we get it to 2/3. And the 2 are outside of Liberia, and they have consented by through telephone conversations.
Former Commissioner of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, John Stewart, told me why endorsing the War Crimes Court delayed since their work ended in 2009.
The primary reason is that the past government did not exercise the political will to put this on the front burner. This time, too many things are happening and nobody is accounting for it. It's an opportunity to put to test, you know, to lay to rest those who the opinion that this thing won't go anywhere. Even if somebody who is accused of perpetrating war crimes leaves Liberia, there's still a possibility that he can be brought to account.
Liberia's civil war was labeled as one of the most barbaric conflicts in Africa. It caused the death of at least 250,000 of the country's population between December 2009 and August 2003.
That was Evelyn Pade reporting from Monrovia, Liberia. Now, we did post put a question on our Facebook page this afternoon. We asked you, is a war crime court a solution to Liberia's deeper problems? Yaya Yuguda, you're saying, I think justice should prevail, but that will not certainly solve.
And Fru Asagda, on his part, says that all war crimes convicts must pay for their crimes.
And Sulamana Walinko Jalo, you're saying, is that safe? Is Liberia more than Sierra Leone? That's your opinion.
and keep the debate going on our Facebook page, DW Africa. We take you a little bit out of the African continent. We begin the show in Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz both have said they are ready to form a unity government, but they disagree on who should take charge.
Netanyahu had previously insisted he would lead a coalition between right-wing and religious parties, but the election results so far have indicated that neither he nor his main opponent, Benny Gantz, of the centrist Blue and White Party, will be able to form a government. For the latest on how the government would work, here is our correspondent in Jerusalem, Tanya Kremer.
I think these are really the early days, and I think what both sides here are trying to do is to basically set out their terms and telling the other party, well, we are willing to do our best to form a unity government, but it's very hard to see how they will actually bridge the gap. I mean, Blue and White has said, Benny Gantz has said, that they would sit with the Likud in a unity government, but a unity government without Netanyahu, because they don't want to sit with a prime minister who is under possible indictment over corruption charges. They have that. They have made that very clear. And also, Benny Gantz has criticized in his statement that Benjamin Netanyahu is coming already with his own set of ideas. Actually, what happened since yesterday is that Benjamin Netanyahu sat down together with his traditional and potential coalition partners, the smaller right-wing parties, the National Religious Yamina and the ultra-Orthodox parties, and they have said they will only come together and negotiate together, whereas Benny Gantz has said in his statement that he wants to see a broad and liberal government and that Netanyahu can't dictate any terms to the negotiations.
That was Tanya Kremer speaking from Jerusalem. And now Rwandan Hutu militia commander Silvestre Muda Chumura, wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes during the 1994 genocide, has been killed.
Now, army spokesperson in the Democratic Republic of Congo said that the leader of the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda was killed in the North Kivu province. DW's Nasra Bishumba now begins by telling us who the rebel leader was.
Muda Chumura was the FDLR leader since 2000. He is considered by the Rwandan government a terrorist, and currently, just before his death on Tuesday, he was being sought for war crimes by the International Criminal Court.
So how are Rwandans reacting to his killing?
It has been some sort of blackout, really. No one seems to be talking about him. I don't know if it's intentional. He has been more popular in Congo, where he has been sought for by the Congolese government. But in Rwanda, really, most people don't actually know him, except people who are in government.
Within the government circles, what are Rwandan officials saying about this?
Interestingly, in Kigali, the government has refrained from saying anything about it. But someone in the government told me off record that it is intentional. They do not want to attract attention to him because that will make him someone so prominent in other people's eyes. So there's not much that is being said about him officially.
Now tell us how his death is likely to affect the FDLR rebel group that Muda Chumura formed in the years after the 1994 genocide of Rwanda's Tutsis.
Definitely it's going to be a big blow because they have in the recent years been weakened by the arrests of several of their leaders. There's been pressure from the military in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then their fight with local armed groups in Congo. So all that put together, and now the death of Muda Chumura, it definitely is going to be a big blow to FDLR.
That is Nasra Bishumba telling us about what Rwandans think about the killing of the Hutu militia commander. Now, we equally ask you on Facebook, what do you think about it? According to Jerome Ajerebo, he says that he was shot dead, meaning he escaped justice. He's just questioning. This is bad news for the international criminal justice.
And Nafiu Mohammed Danjaji, you're saying that's not good. Look at what has happened to Nigeria just because the Boko Haram leader is being killed. Yeah, that's your opinion. Keep it right here. And keep the debate going on our Facebook page. And whenever you write a comment, we'll read it at whenever we can.
Certainly, we can read it all. You're welcome, or you're listening to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. Stay with us for more stories across Africa and beyond. I am Mimi Mefo.
And I am Assumpta Latos. You can also be part of today's program by joining the debate on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Talking about that, I see Babila Donut. You're saying, hello, Mimi. You have lots of fans.
Hi,
here. And Kwame Luki, you are saying, wow, nice one. We're happy to having you here. And Mazi Na Emeka, you're saying that you are watching from Abuja, Nigeria.
And we equally want you to be part of the debates. You already know the topics for today. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Sierra Leonean journalists express hope after government's decision to annul a criminal and libel law.
We are happy with the news of cabinet approval of the repeal of the criminal libel law. We are hopeful also that this is a demonstration of the commitment of the current government to their manifesto promise. We wish that this momentum would continue.
Also coming up, we'll be discussing about opening up your marriage or opening up your relationship to other partners.
Well, before we get there, in just a few minutes to come, we'll take you first of all to South Africa, where South African highest court's ruling that corporal punishment at home violates children's rights has sparked an intense debate on African parenting.
The Freedom of Religion South Africa has warned that preventing parents from spanking their children at home is setting a dangerous precedent and will ultimately destroy families as a foundation of society. Tuzo Kumalo has more.
The South African Constitutional Court has banned all form of corporal punishment by parents. In 2017, the High Court found a father guilty for assaulting his 13-year-old son after he caught him watching pornographic videos. The court found that the assault violated the child's right to equal protection of the law, dignity, and freedom from all forms of violence. Freedom of Religion South Africa, a civil rights organization, approached the Constitutional Court asking it to set aside the ruling on grounds that parents were allowed to reasonably chastise their children under common law defense of reasonable chastisement. However, the Constitutional Court, in a unanimous judgment delivered by Chief Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng, upheld the High Court order.
The appeal is dismissed. It is declared that the common law defense of reasonable and moderate parental chastisement is inconsistent with the provisions of Sections 10 and 12(1)(c) of the Constitution.
And President Cyril Ramaphosa has applauded the court, saying the ruling is a great stride in the protection of children.
Children do need and must be protected from all forms of violence, whether it is in the home, in the streets, or in the schools. That is what the constitution of our country dictates.
But some parents do not agree with the judgment. Daniela Elabek from the Freedom of Religion South Africa says the ruling has just stripped parents of their parental rights.
What has happened with this judgment is that there has been a serious erosion of both parental rights for parents to determine what is in the best interest of their children and for them to raise their children in accordance with their own moral convictions and beliefs.
But Siduduzile Skosana from the Save Children SA disagrees.
When we look at research, spanking is not really achieved anything except that it instills fear in children.
That is Tuzo Kumalo, the reporting from South Africa. Sumta, now spanking is something that is done in many African countries today. Most Africans know the feeling of being spanked.
Yeah, me too, actually. So what does spanking do with us psychologically? Here are my colleagues, Abubakar Jallo from Sierra Leone, Benita van Eysen from South Africa, and Michael Otti from Ghana.
As someone who got beaten by their parents, I understand the need of why you want to beat your child sometimes as a form of punishment, but it's actually not a better solution, because I have come to understand that there are far more better ways of dealing with your child than beating. Beating is absolutely not a solution. If any, it just hampers the child. It just holds the child back from growing, having that freedom of thinking, of doing things.
Until quite recently, anyone who grew up in South Africa, in the townships especially, knows a good hiding. Even as an adult, I'm still around my mother sometimes, and I wonder if she's going to whack me against the back of the head for saying something she didn't approve of or doing something she doesn't like.
I grew up as part of a big family, and one of the things that my parents would do to keep the kids in line was to often speak once and speak twice. The next time, if she was going to correct you, my mom especially, then you're going to get spanked. So once you do something and she says once and she says twice, you don't want her to say anything the third time, because it's not going to be her words that's going to do the talking. It's probably going to be her slippers against your butt that's going to send a message right up into your brain. But I think that ultimately what that did was to help me and my siblings know what was right and help keep us in line.
Well, that's your opinion. And what do you think, Mimi? I mean, it helped him to know exactly what's right and what's wrong. What about you?
Yeah, it helped me as well. It's true, I was frightened, but I learned my lessons. When your parent says, I would beat you or I'll spank you, and he doesn't, or he or she doesn't, it doesn't create an impact. But when you know you'll be spanked or beaten,
and it will hurt.
That is an African phenomenon.
So would you do to your children as
common. Well, there are so many ways to discipline a child. If it means spanking at the right time, not doing it often or always, you should to correct the child. Why not?
Oh, wow. And what do you think about that? Tell us on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
You Zone.
Now, imagine this, Mimi. You have been married for years, but for some reason, there's no longer excitement. Will you consider having an open sexual relationship with other people?
Now, before you make up your mind about that, the 77% debate this week has been focusing on this particular topic. We have been speaking to relationship experts and young people in Africa. Here is a report by Michael Oti.
Marriage starts when two people meet and fall head over heels in love. Although sometimes, this is not the case. Sometimes, years of living together can wear down on partners, and the excitement wanes. Other times, partners simply want to spice things up. That is where the idea of open marriage comes in. An open marriage is one where partners agree that each may engage in extramarital sexual relationships without this being considered infidelity. Relationship expert Karen Lucas explains why opening up to other sexual partners is not ideal in marriage.
Couples who agree to an open relationship have really strong lines of communication, and more often than not, have been having these conversations from the beginning of their relationship. An open relationship is a beautiful concept, and I support it completely, but it requires so much more love and support than a monogamous relationship.
DW hit the streets of Gambia, Uganda, and South Africa to know what people think about opening up their marriage.
A marriage in which a partner is free to have intercourse with another party that is outside wedlock is not a marriage. Consummation in marriage is a commitment between two people to only consummate between their wedlock.
A woman sleeping different men, that woman is regarded as a prostitute. Yeah. Whereas a man, it is not acceptable in my culture.
I just don't believe in open marriage, and I wouldn't be a part of it. Not even polygamy.
So at this point, it was becoming hard to find one person who thought this was a good idea. So we called on our colleagues, Abubakar Jallo and Tracy Kariuki. The two are from Sierra Leone and Kenya respectively. It was a heated debate.
I believe a marriage is a unit. It's a pair that becomes one. And once you open up that pair, do these other people share the same values that you do? Whatever street.
You're talking about values. We're talking about personal choices here. We're not talking about values that affect a society.
But these are personal choices based on values. There is nobody who's going to marry somebody without any meaning or any principle attached to it. There is definitely going to be, there's a reason why these two chose each other.
Indeed.
Amidst of a pool of so many other
suitors. I think you had the right word there, saying that these two chose each other. And at some point, they have difficulties in their relationship. And they choose to open it up because they think that is a solution to it. No one else should be coming in there and judging them.
All in all, an open marriage is an idea that might not be for everyone. Partners ultimately must make that decision.
Michael Oti, they're reporting. It's been a heated debate, as you could hear, Asumta Latos. What do you think about that? Can you open up your marriage to other relationships?
It depends on my partner. I will have to ask him. And if he is willing to do that and he wants to do that, then I think I will do. But it all depends on the agreement, on a partnership. I mean, why would I do that? You have to know, first of all, I guess. But this topic was also on our 77% radio show.
Sure.
You can find it on our page, DW Africa, and also on our YouTube page, which is DW Africa as well.
Speaking out.
In speaking out today, we go to Sierra Leone. The president there, Julius Maada Bio, and his cabinet have approved a repeal of a criminal and seditious libel law. The law, which was enacted in 1965, was targeting journalists and restricting press freedom.
Now, many governments prior to President Bio's have been promising to repeal the law, but none of them did so. From Freetown, our correspondent Claudia Antoni picks up the story.
Prior to the 2018 national elections, Julius Maada Bio met with the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists, during which he requested to know how he could contribute to improve the work of journalists in the country. Of course, Sludge requested a repeal of the half-a-century-old criminal and seditious libel law, which he then made part of his party's manifesto. 18 months after he became president, Maada Bio restated his commitment to repealing the law. Many journalists hailed the move. Ahmed Sahid Nasrallah is the president of Sludge.
We are happy with the news of cabinet approval of the repeal of the criminal libel law. We are hopeful also that this is a demonstration of the commitment of the current government to their manifesto promise. We wish that this momentum would continue to the next stage with this parliament.
For 54 years, Sierra Leone's military regimes and politicians used this law to suppress a free press in the country. Among high-profile cases was that of journalist Dr. Julius Spencer and Mohamed Bangura in 1992. Their New Breed newspaper republished an article copied from a Swedish newspaper that reported a secret sale of Sierra Leone's diamonds. The military regime at that time used the criminal and seditious libel law to nail them. In successive administrations years later, these two became government ministers of information. Others prosecuted by this law included Paul Kamara, Bai Bai Sise, David Tambayo, and Jonathan Lee, who is currently the country's deputy ambassador to the Federal Republic of Germany. The question on many lips, though, is why now? A former journalist, Mamadi Gobe Kamara, has the answer. She is now Deputy Minister of Information and Communication.
Why not now, Claudia? This law was passed 54 years ago, as you know, and President Bio made a campaign promise that he was going to get this particular law expunged from our law books. As far as I'm concerned, this is the right time. It's also a way of letting people know that this government means business. When they say something, they follow up on it. So this is a way of following up and doing exactly what he promised.
The Sludge Head shared with me a list of journalists arrested and detained in recent times. He explained the circumstances through which they brushed with the law and suggested this law was more than a suppression of free press. Here is Ahmed Said Nasrallah again.
Because if you look at the cases we have from that period to now, over 99% of the victims are journalists. and the action brought by politicians. This is basically their strategy to cover the press, to intimidate journalists who are critical and who want to delve into their activities and try to hold them to account.
Now that there is light at the end of this very dark and long tunnel, some people think the consequences could be heavy on the government.
Claudia Anthony, they're reporting from Sierra Leone. Any law, of course, and Assumpta Latus, that protects media workers should be appreciated.
That's true. And that's all we had time for today. My name is Assumpta Latus.
And I am Mimi Mifu. Thank you for listening.
Made for Mind.